Father, as we come before you again this morning and have a discussion about what it means to join your church and to be a part of your body, we do pray that you would help us and that you would help us to understand the commitment that this is and the necessity and the blessings that are connected with being a part of your church. Help us to know these things for Jesus' sake. Amen. Okay, so last week we talked about church membership and went through some of the biblical passages for why church membership is something that the scriptures would promote. I wanted to make a biblical foundation for church membership rather than it just being, you guys can come in if you want. You're okay. All right. Rather than it just being like, this is the tradition. It's what we do. So, you know, you should join because of that. Today, what I want to do is I want to look at a little bit of the history of our church in particular, as far as our denomination, where we come from. Most people that have a relationship with this congregation or other congregations like it, they find the church for specific reasons, and we hear those stories. Sometimes it's because of Reformed theology. Sometimes it's because it's close. You know, it's the neighborhood church. Sometimes we hear that there's relationships. You know, I met so-and-so, and they're a friend, and they go here. And those are all good. Those are good reasons to be a part of a church, but what I want to do is I want to step back and I want to put this particular congregation in a bigger context as far as where we fit in the history of the church, and I want to show you a little bit of what I call the fighting spirit of the Reformed Presbyterian Church, so we'll see that. I'm going to begin with some scripture reading. And I'll read from John 17. These are the words of Jesus as he prays. He says, I have given them, that's the disciples, your word. And the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. But I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world, and for their sake I consecrate myself, that they may be sanctified in truth. I do not ask for these only, but also for those who will believe in me through their word, that they may be one, just as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. The glory that you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, even as we are one, I in them, and you in me, and that they may become perfectly one, so that the world may know that you sent me and love them, even as you loved me. So I want you to notice two things. Number one, this is Jesus praying for the disciples, and in that prayer for the disciples, he prays for this congregation. Okay, you may not see that, but he says, I do not ask for these only. I'm not praying only for the disciples, for the 12, the 11 at this point, that are going to go out and preach, but I pray for all of those that will come to know this truth. So as Christ is praying in the garden for the church and the building of the church, he prays for this congregation. He prays that this church would be built, and that as this church is built, that we would be a part of, this is the second part, that we would be a part of that bigger scope of church history where Jesus says that his desire is that the church would be one. He desires and prays for unity in the church. Now we know some of us know that as church history unfolds, what we haven't seen yet is unity. Those that study church history know that very early on, even in the New Testament, we see divisions and difficulties. So when we think about joining the church, what I want you to think about is, one, you're joining the church, which is that larger body of the work that Christ is doing in the world. And we have a connection with that. Okay, so when you have friends that are Baptists or friends that are Methodists, you have friends that are maybe in Pentecostal churches, and if they're genuine, true believers in Christ, you have a connection to them that is important because Christ has prayed for that. And then secondly, you're joining a specific congregation, a congregation that has its own history within the Church of Christ and its own peculiarities as well. You know, the Reformed Presbyterian Church has its own baggage that we know and some of us love, and that's okay. But when we're joining the church, we need to remember both of those things. So what I want to give is some more opening thoughts, and these are really important. Here's a little comic that I think is funny. Maybe you won't think it's funny. You know, here's two people on a desert island, and the assumption is they get in some little theological argument, and the guy says, maybe then you should just start your own presbytery. You know, there's two of them. That's the joke, right? And the person says, but I just got here. Sometimes church history is dealt with like that, where, especially in Reformed churches, maybe you have friends that will say, oh, I'm a part of this such and such Presbyterian church or this such and such Reformed church. And, you know, we have to try to figure out where that connection is. Sometimes in Presbyterianism, we're called the split peas. You know, there's just like all of these different varieties that we could choose from. But where do we fit? Now, here's what our testimony says. Divisions that separate believers into denominations mar the unity of the church and are due to error and sin. Isn't that funny? We have a denomination that is making the statement that denominations are sinful. I want you to think about that. That really is showing that we understand that this is not the perfect way that Christ has desired for the church. Christ desires something different than a fractured body, even though we deal with the realities of a fractured body. So that's Reformed Presbyterian Testimony 25:14, if you want to look at that. And then another assumption, the church did not end after the apostles and then begin again at the Reformation. This is something that is bad. And sometimes church history is dealt with that way. You know, here's the New Testament, and, you know, you come to the end of the New Testament, and then, you know, there's some good guys and bad guys. You have, like, Augustine, he's a good guy. And then there's silence, and then Martin Luther comes. You know, the church has 1,500 years of history between the end of the New Testament and what we call the Reformation. And those years, those 1,500 years, are really important years, but we don't deal with those very much in our churches. So I'm not going to deal with them either. But, I mean, I've dealt with them, but I'm not going to deal with them here. But I just want you to note that when I come to the next section, that and we start with talking about the Reformation, we acknowledge that the Holy Spirit has always been active in church history. You know, the Holy Spirit's work in building the church is something that we should look for. We should look for that light when we're studying and looking at what history teaches us. So a couple of starting points, as I've already mentioned. We'll start with 1517. I've already told you that this is not the starting point, but it's a good one for us when we think about the Reformed Presbyterian Church. So we know 1517 is a common accepted starting point for the Reformation. It's, do you guys know that date, 1517? Yeah? You know the Martin Luther, what he did? Do you know? I can't hear you.
Sort of.
You want to tell me? No?
Okay.
So Martin Luther hangs something, right? He hangs something on a church door. And it's basically, he starts a fight. He wants to have a discussion about things he doesn't agree with in the Catholic Church. And he hangs 95 things he wants to fight about on the church. But it's not really a fight because he just wants to discuss them. And they're written in Latin because he wasn't wanting to start a fight with regular people. He wanted it to be theologians and church people. So that was 1517. And that's a good starting point. But when we think about the Reformed Presbyterian Church and you guys joining the Reformed Presbyterian Church, there are specific dates that are important. I'm going to share some of those, and you don't have to remember any of them at all. But I want to share some of the story of how we get from 1517 or being a Reformed church to a specific Reformed Presbyterian church. And that's part of our story. I visited Mr. Schaefer's mother-in-law this week, and she told me a story about how she came to Christ, a story about her being raised, a story about her coming to know her future husband, and that helped me to get to know her. And I didn't get to know her just by her giving dates. You know, in 1960, this happened. In 1954, this happened. But I heard a story. So I want to give you some of that story so that you're able to think about whether this particular congregation is where you want to be. So 1528, that's our first date. Skipping a lot, but 1528, there is a man named Patrick Hamilton, and he was a student. He was a college student, and he went to Europe, and he began to study in Europe, and he came into contact with the Reformation. He came into contact with these new ideas that were changing Europe, and a lot of those ideas were what some called Lutheran ideas. And he brings those ideas back to Scotland. He was a foreign exchange student, in a sense. He was studying abroad on the continent. He brought those ideas back to Scotland, and he was preaching and teaching those ideas. And the church didn't like it, and the government didn't like it. And Patrick Hamilton ended up being martyred for his faith. So he is the first Protestant martyr in Scotland. And that did not go over well in Scotland among the people. Another date, several years later, there is a man named George Wishart. And George Wishart was another believer who preached and who taught. And George Wishart believed that preachers should carry swords. So whether you believe in open carry or not, George Wishart believed in open carry of the sword. And he had a young man who carried his sword named John Knox. So John Knox was a bearer of the sword for George Wishart, and was teaching and discipling John Knox in Reformed theology. And George Wishart was told to stop preaching. He was a very gospel-centered preacher. You know, you go to Lake Eola and you'll see guys preaching on Lake Eola. George Wishart would have been there. He would have been one of those guys. And he loved to preach in the open air, and he loved to be protected while he preached. So John Knox got to hear him preach in the open air and held his sword. And eventually, George Wishart was captured, and a man named Cardinal Beaton had George Wishart burned at the stake. And of course, anyone that's ever been in a relationship of disciple and discipler, those relationships run deep. And for John Knox, seeing the one who was raising him up in the gospel and helping him to see the value of both the scriptures and Reformed theology, having him die, that affected John Knox deeply. So in 1546, the same year, Beaton was assassinated. There are people that were really mad at Cardinal Beaton. And so what they did was they stormed a castle where he was. The castle's name is St. Andrew's Castle. Those of you familiar with Ligonier know that the church there is named St. Andrew's Church. That's why it's named St. Andrew's Church. St. Andrew's Church in Edinburgh was where Cardinal Beaton was, and all of these Reformed believers stormed the castle and ended up assassinating Cardinal Beaton. Now, we could pause for weeks and debate whether it's a good idea to assassinate people or not. We'll assume that's not a good idea, but it happened. So, again, there's people that say it's okay and people that say it's not. We're going to assume that we shouldn't assassinate people, but realize that it happened. Now, John Knox, you remember, was the sword bearer. So what's John Knox do? John Knox was not there. He did not assassinate Cardinal Beaton, but he flees into the castle that has been taken over. Okay, so there's a castle. It's the middle of a battle. There is people on two sides of the argument. They're hitting each other with swords. You know, it's a battle. And what John Knox does is he, in this battle, this is months that this castle is sieged. And John Knox realizes that there are people in there that need to hear the gospel. And there are children in the castle. You know, castles are big. There's children in there that need to be catechized. So what John Knox does is he flees into the castle so that he can preach and catechize and teach the people that are there. And as that's going on, John Knox is there preaching and teaching. There's those that are there defending St. Andrew's Castle. There's all this cultural turmoil that's building up between Roman Catholics and Reformed believers in Scotland. And what happens is that the French come. Now, the French are a Roman Catholic nation at this time. And the French capture the St. Andrew's Castle. John Knox is made a slave, and he's put on a ship. And in those days, there were ships that worked their way through the English Channel and in the coast of the Atlantic. And these ships ran on manpower. So they were a little different than our ships today. And you could fill the bottom of a ship with 25 to 50 men and have them row. And that was your power for your boats. And that was often done by slave labor. And John Knox was one of those slaves on a French boat. And there's a story that is pretty funny where John Knox would not stop talking about Christ as he was rowing this boat or this ship. And these Frenchmen were really tired of hearing him talking about Christ and the gospel and the Reformed faith and all of these things. And this one man, a Frenchman who had participated in enslaving Knox, he comes down with a statue, a small statue from the ship of the Virgin Mary, and tries to force John Knox to kiss the statue of the Virgin. Now, John Knox is not known for being a nice guy. If you read any history of Presbyterianism and you read about John Knox, he is like the most feisty person in Reformation history. Knox takes the statue of the Virgin and he throws it out the oar window and he asks the Frenchman if the Virgin knows how to swim. That's his response. Now, you can imagine this does not go over well, okay? But anyways, Knox is enslaved by the French, and in 1549, so he's a slave for 2 years, he becomes a refugee in England. Okay, so he's from Scotland. 2 years, he's floating around the English Channel on a French boat. He's released to England. He can't go back to Scotland, and he's a refugee. So there's some interesting things in this history that connects us with modern day concerns. You know, we have a slavery concern, human enslavement. That's a real concern in our society today. We have refugee concern. Here's John Knox as a refugee in England, and he's there because of religious persecution. These are things that we can, in our history, that we can connect to modern societal concerns and say, we have some of that in our history too. Anyways, he's a refugee in England. He's learning more about the Reformed faith. He's participating in the Church of England and the worship and liturgies within the Church of England. And then in 1553, Mary becomes Queen of England. And what's Mary known as? You know, Bloody Mary, right? She's a drink. So Bloody Mary is called Bloody Mary because she kills Protestants and loves to kill Protestants, thousands of Protestants. So Knox is no longer safe in England. He flees to Geneva, and Geneva's in what country? You guys know? What is it? No? Anyone else know? Switzerland. Okay. So Knox flees to Geneva, and there he meets a man named John Calvin. Okay, so Knox and Calvin connect, and he's learning from John Calvin. And between 1553 and 1559, he's there in Geneva and eventually returns to Scotland and is preaching and is trying to organize churches according to the pattern that he learned in Geneva, okay? And as he preached, Scotland at this time is a very small country. During the Reformation, there's probably a million people in the nation, okay? Edinburgh, big city, maybe 20,000, 50,000 people. These aren't like, you know, this isn't huge like going to New York or, you know, going to big cities like that. This is a small nation, and the cities are small as well. So he goes and he's preaching, and many are converted. Many come to know the Lord and to understand theology according to how Knox is presenting it. Here's some more dates. 1560. So what was the last date? So 1550s. John Knox is preaching. 1560, there are six men named John. Okay, you study Scottish church history, everyone's named John. All right? Seriously, it's all over the place. So there's John, 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 and John who write the Scots Confession. Okay, the six Johns. And the Scots Confession is similar to our Westminster Confession in saying, here's what we believe about the Bible. Here's what we believe about God. Here's what we believe about Jesus. Here's what we believe about what it means to be saved. Here's what we believe about, and etc. And the Scots Confession goes out through the nation, and it becomes approved by the people, and the pastors gather around it, the pastors and elders, and they have what's called a general assembly. Okay, a general assembly is when these ministers and elders who are scattered throughout this little nation called Scotland, they come together for the first time and they say, here's what we believe, Scott's confession. This is what we are working towards preaching and teaching in our churches. And we're going to approve that, and we're going to organize as a church. So that's sort of the birth of what's called the Church of Scotland. Okay, so 1560, important date in our own history. Now, why is it an important date in our own history? Because we come from the tradition of the Scottish Reformation. Now, does it mean that the Scottish Reformation is the best Reformation that occurs in Europe? I'm going to say yes, because I'm biased. But there's other parts of the Reformation that have great value. My seminary training was in a Dutch Reformed seminary. The Dutch Reformed branch of the Reformation has great value. There's great things that the Lord has done in that church. But this is the branch of the church that I'm in. That's why when you're here and you hear Scotland this or Westminster that or those sorts of things, and you think, we're in Florida, who cares what they did in Scotland? It's part of the family history. That's why it's talked about. And that's why it's important to us. So 1560, the Church of Scotland is organized, the General Assembly, and then Church of Scotland's going on, things are going okay, and then there's conflict between Scotland and England. There's a king in Scotland named James, I think, if I remember, James the Fourth, and there's a pastor named Melville who preaches a famous sermon where he reminds the king, King James, but that's not King James from the King James Bible. He reminds King James of Scotland that there are two kings in Scotland. He says there that Jesus is king over the church and James is king over Scotland. And then in that sermon, he goes on to say to the king, James, you are a member of the church, but you are not a king in this church. You are not anything but a member of this church. You will submit to Christ and his authority in the church. Now, that's an important sermon. It's an important date, 1569, because even when elders today in the Reformed Presbyterian Church, when we meet and we close our prayer, Elder Schaefer, how do we close our meetings or even open our meetings?
Recognizing Lord Jesus as King and head of the church.
So we open and close all of our meetings by saying that, acknowledging that Jesus Christ is King and head of the church. Where's that come from? It goes all the way back to 1596 when we're reminding governments that there is a division between the church and the nation. And so our history, or part of our history, is a political history. And you're going to hear things that deal with politics and the government, because that's part of our history as we preach and teach. 1625, Charles I becomes King of Scotland, and Charles I does some really interesting things. He wants to bring the Church of Scotland more in line with the Church of England, and the Church of England has priests and bishops, and the Church of Scotland does not have priests and bishops. And Charles said, well, here's a way that we can convince them that they should be more like the Church of England. We're going to impose bishops on them, but we're not going to change how they worship. So your worship can look like this. You can sing psalms a cappella. You can have long, dry sermons, but you're still going to have a bishop that comes and checks in on you. And Charles's idea was, as long as we don't affect what goes on in the pews, people aren't going to care. Most people aren't going to care. But what happens is there are people that care. 1537, there's a woman in Scotland named Jenny Geddes. And Jenny Geddes is interesting. In those days, there weren't pews in churches. You would come into a big open space, And if you wanted somewhere to sit, you'd bring your own little chair or your own little stool. And the most common, this is an agricultural society for the most part, the most common thing that you would bring is called a milking stool. Raise your hand if you know what a milking stool is. A milking stool is very, very short. My mom grew up on a farm, and my mom can milk a cow. I can't milk a cow, but my mom can milk a cow. And a milking stool is very, very low to the ground. So Jenny Geddes brings her milking stool so that she can sit if she gets tired at church. There is a bishop that begins to read the Mass. Okay, he begins to go through the Church of England's liturgy, and Jenny Geddes takes the milking stool and throws it at the preacher. Okay? Guys, don't throw things at the preacher. Okay? She throws the milking stool at the preacher and basically lectures him and says that the Mass will not be said in her ear. Okay? That's awesome. Okay? She does this, and that story goes throughout Scotland. Now, historians today question whether Jenny Geddes even existed. And they say, well, maybe it's probably just a myth to get people excited. That was never said by historians until recently. So you might hear that sometime. So just don't worry about it. Most historians today don't think anything exists. 1638, there is a national covenant signed. And the national covenant led to revival. The national covenant is basically saying that as a nation, they're going to live under the obedience of Christ. And when you read about the national covenant, it's really pretty cool because there are a lot of people that throughout the nation of Scotland, as they're giving their lives over to Christ, they sign the national covenant in their own blood. And, they would cut themselves, use it to blot the ink, and sign the national covenant. And revival comes throughout Scotland as a result of this. And, you know, it really is a revival of preaching and teaching, and a revival of godly living. It's not just, theological. It really is something where the people are dedicating their lives to Christ. And the National Covenant had a great impact on the society. And then there's another event that's important. In 1642, the English Civil War breaks out. And you think, like, how could a civil war have anything to do with churches or where we are as a body? But civil wars frequently affect national religion. Within our own nation, we had a civil war. And that civil war in the United States divided churches. And you can look at churches' histories, and you can talk about them in relationship to the war. The PCA has a long history that is connected to the war, and whether ministers and elders were pro-slavery or against slavery. Southern Baptist Church. It's called Southern Baptist Church because at one time there was a Baptist church, and when the nation divided, the church divided. And that happens a lot in church history. 1642, the English Civil War breaks out, and they ask Scotland to come and help. Will you send your soldiers over the border to come help with the English war? And remember that the churches between England and Scotland have been debating whether churches should look like Presbyterian churches or whether they should look like Anglican churches. Should we have bishops? Should we have a mass? Should we use a prayer book? Should we do this? Should we do that? And in those debates, it was often the line strictly divided between English thinking and Scottish thinking. And so when the English come to Scotland and they say, can you send warriors down to come defend the king? Scotland says, we will, but first something else is going to happen. You are going to sign what's called the Solemn League and Covenant, and that's just a big fancy term for a covenant. You know, it's solemn because it's holy, and they come together, and the covenant says that they're going to have a meeting, a big church meeting in the midst of a civil war, and they're going to decide what church should look like, what worship should look like, what people should believe concerning God, what people should believe concerning Jesus, what people should believe about church government and singing and worship and all of these things. And England says, okay, we'll sign your little covenant, just send the soldiers. So they send soldiers, Scotland sends soldiers, but they not only send soldiers, they send preachers and teachers and theologians into England. And that is what we call the Westminster Assembly. So you hear in this church, you know, the Westminster Shorter Catechism says, the Westminster Larger Catechism says, our Confession of Faith says, and that is all a document that revolves around a civil war. Okay? That's very, very strange, isn't it? That in our church history, when men were going and shooting each other and defending the belief that we should have a king or not have a king, in our church history, we said, hey, we should write a catechism for the kids, and we should debate whether bishops should be in our churches. And that's part of our church history. And the Westminster Assembly met for 10 years. You can, if you want to spend $1,000, you can buy the minutes to the Westminster Assembly, and you can read what the debates were and what went on. And there's some really funny things in there. Do you know what a clerk is? A clerk is like a secretary. They take the notes during meetings. The Westminster Assembly had 10 clerks so that they could make sure that everything was down that needed to be down. There are debates that happen in the Westminster Assembly where literally none of the 10 clerks wrote anything. They just sat listening and didn't write anything. The Westminster Assembly met in Westminster Abbey in a room. Anyone know the name of the room? The Jerusalem Chamber. Yep, that's the room. And the Jerusalem Chamber has a big fireplace on the wall. It's called the Jerusalem Chamber because all the artwork is history of Israel artwork. And you can read the Jerusalem Chamber. You can even read about it in Shakespeare. Henry the Fifth, is that a Shakespeare play? In that Henry V dies in the Jerusalem Chamber. So it's in Shakespeare as well. The Jerusalem Chamber had a huge fireplace, and the poor preachers brought the firewood, and the rich guys and the royalty sat closest to the fire, even though the poor preachers brought the firewood. So eventually the preachers stopped bringing firewood because they weren't benefiting from it. There's stories at the Westminster Assembly where during debates they could hear gunfire in the background, and the clerks record that. You know, we can hear this. During the Westminster Assembly, the bubonic plague went through London, and a lot of people died while they were debating. And guess what the Westminster Assembly did? They didn't quarantine for a year. they kept meeting. They kept staying in that room and debated. And what the result of that is the Westminster Standards. During that time, you see 1651 is in between 43 and 53. During that time, the English got tired of the debates and they executed their king. Okay, they cut his head off. The men from Scotland responded to that. Do you think the Scots liked that the English king had his head cut off or didn't like it? Any guesses? Go ahead. They did not like it. They packed up their bags and they went back to Scotland. They said, this is not what we agreed to. We didn't agree to king's heads rolling. And so they went back to Scotland. Eventually they come back. And in that same year, a guy named Oliver Cromwell comes to power. Oliver Cromwell is a Puritan. You'll hear about him a lot in church history. And Oliver Cromwell said, we shouldn't have a king. We should have something more like parliamentary leadership. And he wanted the Puritans to be in power. So Oliver Cromwell basically says, you know, I'll do this. I'll be in charge. And we don't have a king anymore. And he says, we don't have a king. I'll call myself the Lord Protector. You know, I don't want anything as gaudy as king, or I don't want to sound vain. I don't want to be the king. I'll just be the Lord Protector of the nation. I mean, that's like sounds worse than king to me. But so Cromwell comes to power in England. And then 1661, Charles II comes to power. And you're thinking, where are we going with this, Pastor Nathan? What happens is under Charles II, he brings a lot of Roman Catholicism back into England and a lot of Roman Catholic practices. In 1662, there's what's called the Great Ejection. Okay, the Great Ejection is when it's declared across England. Remember, they'd made a solemn league and covenant, and they agreed to what the standards would look like in the Westminster Standards. 1662, the government says, to all the preachers, you're going to do what we say. You're going to preach like we want you to preach. You're going to worship like we want you to worship. We're done with this stuff. We're done trying to reform churches. We're done trying to make Presbyterians out of Anglicans. We're done with all of this. And you're all fired. If you can't agree to it, you're fired. That's called the Great Ejection. It's 2,000 pastors lost their job that day. 2,000 men walked and just said, we're done. And what they did was, instead of just saying we're done and then go sell insurance, as okay as selling insurance is, what they did was they said, we'll be in such and such field, or we'll be in so and so that's rich and has a huge house. We'll be in his living room. If you want to hear us preach, that's where we'll preach, and you're welcome to join us. And what that did in Scotland is it started what's called the killing times. Okay, so the killing times are exactly what it sounds like. Those that were standing up for their faith were killed. And those that held convictions about things that a lot of your Christian friends would think are really dumb to debate about, you know, things like what should we sing, or things like is England morally responsible to look like this in church? Things that people don't even think about today. Where they were put to death for it. There's stories in the killing times about children that were put to death, or women that were put to death. This isn't just a bunch of like overly testosteroned guys fighting about things to fight about. These are people that really believe their faith and believe in Christ and are willing to defend even their own lives for it. And historians estimate that in Scotland during the killing times that there were 20,000 people that gave their life. And of those 20,000, they were people that really still believed that what happened back in 1643 and then behind that in 1638, that those covenants should be upheld, that people were morally responsible for doing what they said, that church would look like this and we would believe these things and preachers would preach like this and elders would uphold these ideas. And the pejorative name for those that believed those things became known as the Covenanters. That historically is a negative term. You're a Covenanter. You care about the covenants. You're a Covenanter. And, you know, you come into this church, a Reformed Presbyterian church, and some you'll meet older guys, maybe older guys in other denominations that will say, oh, you go to the Covenanter church. And they don't mean it as in a negative way. That's just what we've been called. You know, Reformed Presbyterian churches are often called the Covenanter church. The denominational magazine right now is called the Reformed Presbyterian Witness. 20 years ago, it was called the Covenanter Witness. And that discussion goes back 150 years, going back and forth between being called the Covenanter Witness and the Reformed Presbyterian Witness. But you'll hear that phrase, the Covenanters, Covenanter, you know, Covenanter minister, Covenanter this. That comes from the killing times. 1688 comes. There's what's called the Glorious Revolution. A guy named William of Orange, he's Dutch. He comes to England and he says, you guys have been fighting about religion for a long time. We'd like you to stop fighting about religion. And I'm going to have you stop fighting about religion. And he pulls a big reset on the nation. And he says, everything that's happened, we're going to forget about it. And we're just going to start over, and we're going to be a Reformed church, and we're going to love each other. And a lot of people went with that. It's called the Glorious Revolution. But as he did that, what he's forgetting is that, your grandpa gave his life, or your mom has scars on her face from a sword. You say, well, how do you just reset? You know, how do you have just a glorious revolution where you say, hey, we all love each other, everything's fine now, when there's a real history that that needs to be discussed? This is a long paragraph, but I ramble, so I wanted to transition. Charles tried to impose Episcopal government on Scotland while leaving their church services unchanged. To his surprise, a third of the ministers gave up their homes and incomes rather than submit to the bishops. Thousands of commoners refused to listen to their preachers. They went into the field conventicles to hear their old Presbyterian ones. Battles raged. Covenanters were imprisoned, killed, and exiled by the thousands. Over time, a variety of indulgences lured ministers back to their homes. Three rebellions failed: Pentland Hills, 1679, Bothwell Bridge, and 1680 in San Quahar. I'll just mention, these guys are—they're really fighting for their faith, like with guns. Okay, Bothwell Bridge. There's a story about the Covenanters, and they're being pursued by the English army, and they're going to arrest these men. The Covenanters had procured cannons and boxes, crates with cannonballs, and they open, as the English army is coming upon them, they open these new crates and they're going to fire at the English army. And the crates, all the cannonballs had been replaced, so they had nothing to fight. And the army comes over the bridge, and they arrest them all, and they take them away. 1680, Richard Cameron, they disowned the king and James. They were killed in a sharp engagement a few days later. And by that time, there was one Covenanter minister left named Donald Cargill, and he excommunicated the king. And as he was being martyred, he said, I go up to this ladder with less fear and perturbation than of the mind than I ever entered a pulpit to preach. The Covenanters, now without ministers, organized themselves into societies and had private worship to coordinate their efforts. And now they were known as society people, or as Cameronians. That's after Richard Cameron. And they bore the brunt of the government's determination to stamp out rebellion in what became known the Killing Times. The last Cameronian preacher, James Renick, looks like Renwick, but it's Renick, was ordained in 1683 in the Netherlands. And he was trained by a man named Wilhelmus of Brockel. Wilhelmus of Brockel writes a very good four-volume systematic called The Christian's Reasonable Service. At one time in the Netherlands, it was every home had a Bible and a copy of a Brockel. And on Sundays, dads would read a Brockel to their children because a Brockel is so readable that you can read it and it's a systematic theology, but it warms your heart. So Wilhelmus of Brockel trained the last Covenanter minister, and then he gets back to Scotland and writes this declaration for why he's rejecting the king's authority. So the Killing Times I mentioned, there's lots of stories that you can read, and these stories have been shared in the church. I'm sure Mr. Schaefer, as a little boy, sat through many Sunday school lessons just hearing stories about martyrs. That was very, very common in our denomination to hear stories of martyrs. And a lot of people are named after martyrs in our denomination. There will be old guys with funny names like Renick and Cameron and names like this, Cargill for a first name, and they're named after martyrs. You'll meet little girls named Margaret for the same reason. There's a book called The Scots Worthies, and The Scots Worthies is a book that's filled with these martyr stories that you can read, and there's literally hundreds and hundreds of them. And England, you can go to the Covenanters' prison. It's still there, and you can visit this place where Reformed Presbyterians died and were imprisoned. And some of the this time during the Killing Times, the Covenanters made flags, and they flew those flags as they fought. This is a common one. This is a common one for Christ and His truth. No quarters for active enemies of the covenant. This one for religion, king, and kingdoms. Kingdoms is plural. And then this one that you'll recognize as one that is in probably 95% of Reformed Presbyterian churches. There as a reminder, and some of you may have said, what is with that flag? Why is that there? And that flag is in our churches in part as a reminder of a martyr past, and it's there also as a reminder that Christ's desire for the church is unity, not disunity. From 1899, Harper's Weekly article on slavery in the United States, these are the three common slaves in historically that came to the New World. And the first two sets of slaves, you'll notice, are not black but white. And the reason for that in part is because the first Scottish Presbyterians, the first Reformed Presbyterians that came to America were sent in the end of the 1600s by Oliver Cromwell, and they were sold as slaves. And others followed. Many came from Ulster Plantation in Ireland, where James had given land taken from Catholic owners to Presbyterians and Puritans. And then under the leadership in what would become the United States, Alexander Craighead, the Covenanters in 1738 renewed their adherence to the National Covenant in Middle Octorara, Pennsylvania. So this church, our history is that is a Scottish history, and it's a martyr history, and it's a history that that many have shed their blood for. And when Reformed Presbyterians first came to the New World, they didn't come in the same way that other European immigrants came, where they didn't come for religious freedom at first. They came on slave ships. In 1738, I mentioned Octorara, Pennsylvania. And then 1752, there was a communion service in Pennsylvania of Reformed Presbyterians. It's called Junkin's Tent. And 250 people were at that communion service. And that is really the starting point of the Reformed Presbyterian Church in America. So 1752, that's older than our country, right? 1776 is our nation's birth. And before that, many years before that, Reformed Presbyterians were already here preaching and teaching and establishing churches. Here's a historical marker that you can see in the middle of Pennsylvania. It's middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania, marking the first Covenanter communion service in the New World. And that's strange. The state of Pennsylvania realizes that that was an important historical event. And then where do we stand? You know, there's lots of Presbyterians. We're a specific type of Presbyterian, as I try to give you in the story of our family. If you look at this, there's basically three types of Presbyterians in the United States. There's Presbyterian, there's Reformed Presbyterian, and Associate Presbyterian. And you can follow that in the divisions and splits and figure out where everybody comes from. But the line that's all the way to the bottom, Reformed Presbyterian and Associate Presbyterian, what happens is they come together in 1782 and they join as one denomination. Florida has tons of ARP churches. ARP Church is the combination of the Reformed Presbyterian Church and the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church, or the Associate Presbyterian Church. One of our early church histories, written in 1888, is a guy named William Melanchthon Glasgow wrote a history, and he talks about this this merger between the Reformed Presbyterians and the Associate Presbytery, and he says that in a desire for two churches to become one, two churches became three. Because what happens is, in that merger, that new denomination, the ARP, there was a merger, and that's good. It's good where the body of Christ comes together. But the Associate Presbyterian Church stayed out, part of them, and the Reformed Presbyterian Church had people that stayed out of that merger. And so two became three instead of one. And the Associate Presbytery continued alongside of the Reformed Presbyterian Church in the United States until 1969. And there were four Associate Presbyterian congregations left in 1969, and they joined the RPCNA. So in a sense, there's two ARPs in the United States. And we're one of them because we had the last of the APs join us. And then there's the ARP that some of you may know in other parts of Florida in the South. And then there's the regular Presbyterian Church. And that's the one, there's one down here. Is this street straight down? That street straight down. There's, you know, the big Presbyterian Church. That's a different brand, so to speak, in our country. We don't, our split goes all the way back to the Glorious Revolution. Remember that when William of Orange comes in and he says, let's all be friends? Those Presbyterians said, okay, we can be friends. We'll forget about the war. We'll forget about the killing. We'll forget all that stuff. And we'll be a part of that. So PCA, OPC, we have friends here from the Free Church of Scotland continuing. They're all part of that line of Presbyterians that goes back to the Glorious Revolution. Those that were unable to say, it's okay that you killed our grandma, that's the Reformed Presbyterian Church. They stayed in that line. So Presbyterian family connection in our nation is one that is divided in a lot of ways. But it's important to know where we come from. So when Sundays you come through those front doors or you come up the ramp, you're coming into a church that has a history, in the same way that when you come to a new family or when you meet a new family and you say, tell me your story, they have a story that they can tell. And that story is something that has highs and lows. It's something that has things that we've done right, and there's things that we've done wrong, and that's okay. Every family has that story. But it's important for you all to know that as you consider joining this church and becoming a part of this body, that you come into something with history, something that has a story, and it's good to know that. So we'll end there.